Japanese girl I married. So we stopped the conversation. And I found that she was doing a 3-year study program in Germany, and she was in year two. And so I said to her, you get homesick, are you homesick? And she said to me, no, because the Eucharist is my home now. I was staggered. I
literally kind of took 2 steps backwards. It wouldn't occur to me to say anything so profound. So there's a thing there about, we were discussing it, a few of us were discussing it yesterday, there's a thing there about belonging and place, which goes right the way back to the beginning of the Christian story, at least anyway to the 90s, the epistle to Diognetus, and the famous remark that for Christians, every fatherland is a foreign land, and every foreign land is a native land. And so just what constitutes home, what constitutes belonging? To have the Eucharist, to be able to share it with you, feels like just being part of home. Well, the theme this morning is what we were beginning to get onto yesterday, which is housing. And the question I want to ask to begin with is whether houses matter, do houses matter? And there are quite a lot of things in our scriptures which seem to say that houses don't matter. So the first image that you have is a little picture of David and the prophet Nathan. It's actually a later part of the story where Nathan is telling off David about his dalliance with Bathsheba. But in 2 Samuel 7, there's this wonderful, rich reflection on Bait, on the house. And at the beginning of 2 Samuel 7, we learn that David is living in his house. And then, because he's living in a house, he proposes that Yahweh should have a house and makes plans for it. And Nathan goes along with it. But then, on receiving a word from the Lord, he goes back to David with the word from Yahweh. I have never lived in a house. All the time we were journeying from Egypt to the promised land, I never lived in a house. My house is the house of Israel. And so, in a very fundamental way, there's a kind of relativization of the whole thing about place, about home, and about house. Yahweh, as we are often told, is a journeying God. And Richard Sennett, in one of his meditations on the urban order, says, the thing for us is we can't attach too much significance to domesticity, to the house, because, I quote, our gods are inclined to wander. So there's that theme in our scripture quite profoundly. Now, the second slide. Our friend Amos, who has this stringent critique of the luxury housing of the rich. And with a lot of the prophets, I'm reminded of Balzac's words that behind every great fortune lies a great crime. Amos in chapter 5 is saying, you know, you only have these great houses, you only have your city house and your summer residence because you're exploiting the poor. That's the only reason that you have them. And so there's a real question mark put to those of us who aspire to gracious living. And that question mark is reinforced in our Gospels, where we learn that the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. It's reinforced by Jesus' teaching that we must not lay up treasures for ourselves on earth. And on the basis of that, some Christians want to say that it's good for us not to be tied to place. So Carsten Harris, in his book on the ethics of the built environment, says, we don't want place as destiny. Now, where we are culturally right now, it's hard for us to hear that. But if you go back 150 years, for Marx and Engels, for example, in the Communist Manifesto, and for many other thinkers, not necessarily political radicals, in the early to middle of the 19th century, place seemed to be fate, because transport was so difficult, and so when Marx and Engels talk about the idiocy of rural life, what they're thinking about is the constriction that brings with it, the impossibility of sharing ideas, the impossibility of any kind of creative leisure, and all of that sort of thing. So Harris says, humans are eccentric and essentially homeless. And you can see that, the metaphor of pilgrimage in our tradition. So to be human is simply to be on pilgrimage. That's how many times has that been said by our theologians, by our spiritual writers, by our poets? So we're always journeying. We know that we're journeying. So then where do we belong in terms of place? Yeah. So that's one way of looking at it. But then, if you go to the next slide, Matthew 16, 18. You are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church. Now, I was brought up, as a theological student, I learned that that was a creation of the early church. Jesus never said it. So there's perhaps in there a kind of early bid for Roman primacy. And I put that view in Heidelberg a couple of years ago when I was doing a seminar there, and Ulrich Ducrow took me up in the discussion and said, no, that's a mistake, because what you haven't done, you haven't translated that remark back into the Aramaic that Jesus would have used, or into the Hebrew. And so when Jesus says, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build what? Okay, so we're suspicious about it because we read it in Greek or Latin as ecclesia, and we all know about ecclesia, and we're very jaundiced with it. But if instead of reading ecclesia, you read Kahal Yahweh, the Kahal Yahweh, then the whole thing reads differently. On this rock, I will build Kahal Yahweh. And why is it different? Because what Kahal Yahweh is the moot. It's the gathering of the people of God to explore policy, to think about what it is that God wants them to do in their given situation. That's what Kahal Yahweh is. And of course, Ecclesia originally also had that kind of political significance. So what Kahal Yahweh is the gathering of people under the promise of God to reflect on first, and then to try and put into practice God's purposes for humankind. Okay? It's the gathering of the people of God to reflect on and then try and put into practice God's purposes for humankind. And if that's the way you read it, then I think Jesus may very well have been the author of this saying. And then also you've got Jeremiah 29, the famous text where the exiles are saying, oh my goodness, you know, we're going away from Israel. What can life mean? By the waters of Babylon we sit down and weep. We don't belong. And so you spend your entire time, all your emotional energy, in thinking, when can I get back? I want to be back. Only there does life mean anything. And Jeremiah says, that's rubbish. Build houses and dwell in them. Seek the good of the country to which you are sent. Okay? Put down roots. And of course we know that the Jewish community did do that. And there was the return back to Israel, not everybody went. Lots of Jews stayed in Babylon, and that became the root of a Jewish community, which, as far as I know, may still be there today. It was certainly there in the Middle Ages. And then, next slide, 1 Corinthians 6, bodies are temples of the Spirit. When I was trying to find an image for this this slide, if you put body into Google search, most of it wasn't very appropriate, let's put it that way. Anyway, I thought this one would do. So, bodies are temples of the Spirit. Now, you know, there's 2,000 years of Christian commentary about what that means for our sexuality, which is the way in which that's what Paul is talking about when he says it. But other things come from it. How do we care for bodies? How do we care for bodies? The fact that bodies are temples of the Spirit led the medieval church to pioneer the development of hospitals. Okay? How do we house them? Now, unfortunately, the fact that bodies are temples of the Spirit did not lead the medieval church to think about what was the appropriate way for housing bodies. And I, as I said yesterday, I think part of the reason for that is this very, very deep conviction mediated through Neoplatonism, Pseudo Dionysius, that hierarchy, the heavenly realm is hierarchical, that God intends things to be hierarchical, and therefore the rich man in his castle and the poor man in his gate is divinely intended. And so there's absolutely nothing wrong in having this kind of vast social divide written into the built environment. So the church hasn't asked that, but we ask it. Because I think for all kinds of reasons, we're much more aware of the egalitarian implications of the gospel. And I always remind people that in Alistair MacIntyre's Short History of Ethics, which for my money is probably the best one-volume history of ethics, written at a time when MacIntyre was thought himself not a Christian. He began as a Christian, then thought he wasn't a Christian, now he thinks he's a Christian again. He says, the most important thing that Christianity has contributed to the conversation of the worldwide conversation of ethics is the notion of equality. So, if that's the case, taking bodies seriously means, how do we house them? And then today, in our world, that means, how do we house 6 billion, 8 billion, 10 billion, 12 billion? Where is world population going to plateau? So the business about caring for bodies is an urgent question to us, given the population explosion. And then there's an architect. Unfortunately, he's got Alzheimer's, may not even be alive now. It's more than a year since I checked up on his health, and by that time he wasn't able to see people. This is Christopher Day, who all of his life, as a practicing architect, has tried to explore the spiritual significance of buildings. And Day says, we don't look at buildings, we breathe them in. We don't look at buildings, we breathe them in. They are the third human skin. And we got onto that a bit yesterday. And it's a very familiar thing. So Winston Churchill's famous remark about the rebuilding of the House of Commons in London, we shape our buildings and then they shape us. So There is a kind of, you can relativize that, because human beings rise above their environment. So it's possible for there to be triumphs of the spirit in concentration camps, and there were. In Theresienstadt, you remember that they had an orchestra which used to play the whole repertoire of Western classical music. It's possible for there to be triumphs of the human spirit in slums, in ghettos, all over the place. But the fact that it's possible for humans to rise above their environment is not an argument for simply letting things be. On the contrary, if we're taking bodies seriously as temples of the spirit, if we acknowledge that buildings are the third human skin, if we acknowledge the way in which the built environment makes an emotional, a spiritual impact on us, then it seems to me we are required to pay attention to our built environment, to think about the spiritual quality of buildings, and to seek a built environment which furthers our spiritual well-being, our whole human well-being, as opposed to preventing barriers against which we have to struggle before we attain any kind of fullness at all. And if you go to the next slide, so houses express a moral order. For those of you who can see the pictures there, I've got some turf-roofed houses in Ireland there, in the top left-hand corner. And then I've got some standard semi-detached houses in North London in the bottom right-hand corner. These houses express a different vision of the world, a different moral order. Go to the next slide. That's speculative building, which is the absolute norm in Britain today. I think the United States is much, much better than we are in terms of self-build, because you have a tradition of, you know, individual robust craftsmanship, making things for yourselves, including houses. In Britain, we've been radically disempowered. So we have the lowest level of self-build of any country in Europe, and probably of any country in the world. And this is the kind of stuff which is put up all the time. What's the spirituality of it? What's it about? It's actually a vision of a petty bourgeois world, profoundly individualist, which has almost no concept of a relationship to the natural world, of a relationship to place, an understanding of class or gender, just not thought through at all. And if you go to the next slide, this is an example from the city where we lived for 4 years in Scotland, Dundee. An absolutely fascinating example. That first slide you've got now, it's got some trees and houses on the left. This was an estate, municipal housing, built by the local council out of local taxes for working class people, put up in 1919. And that estate, till today, has no vandalism. There are huge waiting lists to get onto the estate. It is, by and large, litter-free. It's quiet. There's lots of play space for the children. And it's it's a locus for real community, by which I mean people talk to each other, they help each other, they share things, they do things together, and so on. Now, if you go to the next slide, this was similarly municipal housing, which was built in the 1960s. about 2 miles away from that estate that the previous night. That housing, built in the 1960s, is being pulled down today. Because right from the start, it's been a focus for drugs, for vandalism. The houses have proved unlettable. The estates, there were two or three of them that were built at that time, have all failed. Why? What's the difference? I think that part of the difference, and I've explored this with Dundee City Council, we've thought about it, part of the difference is simply in the quality of the building. So the earlier estate was laid out according to the principles of Raymond Unwin. He wasn't the actual designer, but it followed his principles. The houses were well built, they were solid. There was a good level of noise insulation. There was a lot of green space. People felt when they lived there that they'd come somewhere worthwhile. The whole estate was laid out in little cul-de-sacs as well, so that the houses actually, in terms of their physical organisation, brought you together. Now, the 60s estate, rows of houses, bleak. You may remember, the older ones among you may remember, that there was a great spy scandal in the early 60s. There were two British spies, Burgess and McLean, who had sold nuclear secrets to the USSR. And I can't remember whether they fled to the USSR or whether they were exiled there. Anyway, that's where they ended up. And in the 80s, they wanted to make a film about Burgess and McLean and how they ended up in a bleak Moscow housing estate. And when they looked for somewhere to shoot, they used this housing estate as a kind of image of the terrible thing. Yeah.
In the picture we're looking at, the foreground seems to be not the similar housing estate. Is it the apartment, the estate we can see more on the horizon?
No. It's the foreground and. They're both municipal, both sets of municipal housing, but the 1920s estate, 1919, 1920, just is actually better built. Probably a greater density, but better organised recreational space, far more trees.
Look at the parking strip,
yeah.
And the cars parked alongside that.
Yeah.
Pedestrian shelter there.
Yeah.
On the previous slide.
The street layout is completely different.
Yeah. So, in terms of thinking about, so do houses matter? If we're going to build estates, you know, do they have impacts on the quality of life of people? Yes, they do. And it's important to recognise that. And William Morris is an ambivalent figure, I suppose. He's another one of these aristocratic socialists, lived in great luxury himself at Kelmscott House, but had passionate views about how people ought to live. And he says, every person should be ensured, first, honourable and fitting work, second, a healthy and beautiful house. Third, full leisure for rest of mind and body. So first, honourable and fitting work. Second, a healthy and beautiful house. Third, full leisure for rest of mind and body. And I reminded you yesterday that at the end of World War II, the US government at the time also committed itself to the principle that every person has a right to a decent house in a suitable environment. In the West, in this country, in Europe, we spend a third of our life in our homes, three quarters of our social life, and a third of our capital. Now, just as in the built environment at large, which we were talking about yesterday, so it's true with houses, that every house expresses an anthropology, a view of the human. And because it does that, it also expresses a view of society. If you go to the next house, this is the excavation of a Neolithic site in the Orkneys. This is a quotation from Lewis Mumford. "Even in the crudest Neolithic village, the house was always more than mere shelter for the physical body. It was the meeting place of the household. Its hearth was a center of religious ceremony. It was the home of the household god," and I've given you a Roman lares in the next slide. "The locus of the family's being as repository of moral values not measurable in money." Now, if we go on, I want to try and distinguish, and this is something for discussion afterwards, I don't know whether it's adequate, I've tried to distinguish four types of house. So the first is the vernacular, the next is pedigreed house, the next is mass housing, and then suburban housing. Let's start with vernacular architecture. If you go on to that slide, Adolf Loos, who himself was a severely modernist architect, nevertheless has this wonderful remark: "The houses of peasants are shaped by the hand of God." And in all vernacular architecture, it seems that at the heart of it, what it's about is response to place. So vernacular architecture is, by definition, an architecture which emerges from the local. So it embodies a response to climate, it uses local materials, and it embodies social form and tradition. Characteristically, it's rich to the senses and, says Christopher Day, warms the soul. And in vernacular architecture, there's no lust for dominance. This is a phrase of St. Augustine, for whom, as you remember, pride is the worst human sin. And in the City of God, Augustine talks about the libido dominandi, the lust for dominance which marks the earthly city. He was thinking of Rome. And we'll see, looking at some of the other buildings I've got pictures of, there is a real lust for dominance, but not with vernacular architecture. So I've given you there on that slide a picture of my local vernacular, and as Eric knows, this is the kind of house, not quite as big, that I live in. Which is, as I said yesterday, mud and thatch. The thatch that we live under is not actually any longer local, and that's because our farmers use so much nitrogen in growing their crops, and it means that if we use the local wheat straw, our roof would only last for 6 or 7 years. So we've had to get in reed, which hasn't got those kind of nitrogen inputs. So that's the vernacular of the west of England. The next picture is vernacular from the area called Kent, the county called Kent, which is south of London, clay. So it's clay and forest, and that mixture of timber and brick with clay tiles on the roof is the vernacular of that part of the world. The next slide is the vernacular from the middle of England, the Cotswolds, lots of stone usually stone tiles on the roof. Then there's vernacular from North Africa next, very beautiful. Again, clay marred with these wonderful washes on the wall. And the next is vernacular from Batang. What these houses would look like replicated for cities of millions, I don't know, but certainly in these small settlements, they are very attractive. So that's the first kind of housing that I want to think about. And what I've been arguing for in Britain for the past few years is a return to the vernacular. Rediscovering local styles of building, trying to use local materials, trying to encourage people to build for themselves. And you mentioned the thing about straw bale housing yesterday, and I mean, why shouldn't straw bale housing be a form of the vernacular? I mean, why shouldn't it be? And say something more about that in a moment with eco-building. Let's come on to pedigreed building. If you come to the next slide.
Was the last one on baton?
Yes. The next slide, this is Chatsworth House, the home of the Duke and Duchess of Devonshire, I think it is. Nice little pile there. even bigger than Jefferson's Place. The next slide there is Blenheim Palace. When you go in there, there's a little pediment which tells you that it was built by a grateful nation. I wonder what the people who lived around who lost a leg if they tried to get into the estate through the man traps thought about that. That was given because the first Churchill had managed to defeat the armies of Louis XIV a number of times. And then if you go on, you'll recognise your very own Frank Lloyd Wright. This is also pedigreed building. This is not building which can be endlessly replicated, which can be available to all. It's not democratic building. The remark which speaks most to me about these buildings is from Raymond Williams' book, The City and the Country. I was thinking about it yesterday up at Monticello. This is what he says. Look at what those fields, those streams, those woods, even today, produce. Think it through as labour. What these great houses do is break the scale. By an act of will corresponding to their real and systematic exploitation of others. To stand in their shadow, even today, is to know what many generations of countrymen bitterly learned. And will you then think of community? So, I think that there's a real problem with these things, and I don't quite know what to do with them. In Britain, two things are happening. Many of the great palaces of the past now belong to an organisation called the National Trust, which is not owned by the government, but which is a charity to which many of us subscribe, and which takes over these properties and opens them to the public. So puts them into a kind of public ownership. The problem with it is that they become museums. And it just becomes part of the heritage industry. And as you know, today Britain is largely a theme park for North American visitors. There's not much life in that either. But it does democratize them in some kind of way. And I suppose that this is what's happening at Monticello as well. So that's one of the things that's happening. The other thing that's happening is that there are huge amounts of hot money swilling about. And over the past 20 years, there's been a new wave of building great houses. I think I'll tell you this story now. Last week, I had this experience. My youngest daughter's lived on an eco community for the past few years, and you'll see a picture of it in a moment. And I spent Friday of last week with a couple who live in a yurt, and they've got children, and they're negotiating to rent an old caravan, a small caravan, which would kind of go from that door to the wall there. But they want to try and find a rent for that caravan because it's got electric light, and their yurt hasn't got electric light. That was the Friday. The Saturday, I went to look at the place where my daughter's boyfriend works. He works in agricultural planning, and they're based in a 19th century mock castle. A great estate owned by the CEO of Vodafone, which one of these nasty bleepy things that people use. We walked around the estate, it's hundreds of acres, we walked around the estate, and then we went through another park and we saw this little building peeping up over the hill, and thought, well, that looks interesting, and let ourselves in through the gate and walked up and came back down. There was this huge 4x4, you know, kind of, get two of them in this room, and we thought, oh dear, you know, now we're for it, because there were fierce notices saying, no trespasses, you will be shot if you put a foot on this land, etc. And we, oh dear, what are we going to do? And it turned out just to be the gardener. And the owner was away, and my daughter chatted him up, and he said, well, do you want to look around the grounds? And we said, yeah, we'll look around the grounds. And he showed us around the grounds, and we saw the vegetable garden and the lake and the flower garden and this, that, and the other. And then I pushed off. I thought, well, I said, thank you very much, and I left. And then I heard my daughter's boyfriend thundering down the path. He said, he's going to show us around the house. So went back up, and we looked around this house, which is top-lit like this. It's an early 19th century house. And the contrast with the yurt of the previous day was just positively obscene. I mean, this guy is the chairman of British Airport Authority, so he runs all of these horrible airports from which I flew yesterday or the day before. And he runs London Transport, and money oozed from every pore. Pictures worth £20,000-£30,000, that's, you know, $50,000-$60,000 on the wall, great modern art, Matisse, all sorts of things. And I felt almost kind of defiled being there. I felt really profoundly ill. even though it's a very beautiful place and the grounds are very beautiful, the contrast between these two lifestyles was just too more than I could cope with. So, vernacular architecture and pedigreed architecture. Let's move on to the next slide, mass housing. I don't know what the story in this country is, you'll be able to tell me, but the story in Europe is, certainly in Britain, is that mass housing is an invention of the Industrial Revolution, and it followed the rise of the factory system. And so factory owners needed to put up thousands of dwellings for their operatives, as they were called, their workers, so that they could work their 16-hour day. Okay, they needed to be close to the factory so they could stumble out of bed to the factory and stumble back, get a bit of sleep, come back again, etc. And this is how the great industrial cities arose. That's a picture of Edinburgh tenements there, Laura. I don't know whether you recognise them. And there, this is for Heidi's benefit. Where's that, Heidi, in the next slide? Well, it's meant to be the Bronx. That's what the internet image told me it was. Anyway, okay. If you go to the next one, this is very, very typical British mass housing, back-to-back housing, where the houses have no yards, they have no gardens. You have streets and the two houses back onto each other. This was a very common form of housing. We still have quite a lot of this housing remaining. And let me quote Lewis Mumford on this stuff. He says, by working class standards, the house was an immense achievement. People slept on a different floor than they ate. The smell of urine and feces no longer pervaded the interior. So that's his comment on the back-to-backs. My grandparents lived in one of those houses, very tiny indeed. They had 11 children. There were three bedrooms in the house. So when one went there, one felt that the place was, you know, incredibly overcrowded, tight, and yet in those houses there was one room which wasn't used, which was the parlour, in which there was a little biscuit barrel with biscuits of indeterminate age, which were only ever ate when the grandchildren went there, as far as I can work out. Then if you go on to the next slide, the tower blocks, which became the rage after World War II. I think here the skyscraper tradition is much older, isn't it? You've had a different story with them. They've not been popular in Britain at least. And this is Peter Hall's comment on them. The cold brutality of the architecture made the blocks feel bleak and comfortless, and alienation, loneliness, and stress became common experiences. And this is a comment from, 15 years ago. Psychoneurotic illnesses are three times higher than in low-level detached buildings in these tower blocks. Now, thinking back to what we were talking about with Milton Keynes yesterday, see, Milton Keynes, as I said, for the first 20 years, have no buildings more than three stories. And what they're now doing is building tower blocks in the valleys. So they're not going to have buildings which are towering over others, but where there are natural depressions, they're putting tower blocks in order to increase urban density. But the eye will not see huge discrepancies of scale. As a way of increasing density, of using land efficiently and economically, of course they make a lot of sense. And that was one of the things that Le Corbusier argued for in advocating them.
But Tim, I think Jane Jacobs makes this point that it's not just the scale from street level up that's crushing in the spirit. It's the from the window down. The children, when they're above four or five stories and can't see the faces on the street, that seems to be the disconnect.
So yes.
That solution doesn't seem to get at that.
It's interesting, isn't it? You must tell me what your experience is of these places. And why is it that tower blocks are so different from European apartments? Because in the great European cities, people have lived in apartments till today. Now, they're usually six or eight stories. But when you go into them, they're very spacious and roomy. There's lots of square footage or meterage or whatever you want to call it. And people thrive in them. So what's the difference there? That's something that we can try and explore. So if you go to the next slide, that's in this country here. That's the Pruitt degree scheme being demolished, blown up. Three cheers. Go to the next slide. Mass housing. There are the favelas of Latin America, and the Cheris, that's Bombay there, the Cheris of India. And there's a wonderful man called John Turner, who is a planner and architect, and who spent his life in Latin America working in the favelas, trying to improve sanitation, provision of basic services, and so on. And he says that whilst from the outside, favelas and cheris may look chaotic, disordered, dreadful, actually inside they are often places of beauty and order. And if you go, I put a quotation from him next. When we think of what the poor do to house themselves, we must agree that never did so many do so much with so little. When we look at what corporations and governments did for them, we see that never was so little done for so many with so much. Suburbia. Okay. Now, I don't know, how many of you here come from suburbia? Okay, there's a few of you. Suburbia in planning literature, on the whole, has a very bad press. The first slide that you've got there is a picture of Hampstead Garden Suburb, which was built by Raymond Unwin, or designed by Raymond Unwin, I should say. And modern suburbia, as we know it, begins in the 1820s, and it's a deeply romantic conception. So it's about Rus in Urbe, it's about the country in the city. And already by the 1840s, there were pattern books for suburban villas, which offered you the Burmese style, the Egyptian style, the Venetian style, the Morisco style, the Spanish style, and the Plantagenet castle style. Wonderful idea for all of these places. Now there, if you go to the next slide, that is North London, suburbia. And then if you go to the next slide, your very own Levitt Town. And the next slide after that is an aerial view. A.E. Edwards says, of all the suburbs, the most narrow and depressing is the typical garden suburb. It has neither the crowded interest of the town nor the quiet charm of the country. It gives us neither the advantages of solitude nor of society. So it falls in between two stools. I quoted Jane Jacobs yesterday. Eric has told us that she died yesterday. She says suburbia is not a bad place for people without any ambition. But suburbia was defended by Sir James Richards. I haven't found out where Sir James Richards lived. I don't know whether he lived in suburbia or not, whether he had an ancestral pile. I guess that he didn't live in suburbia. Anyway, this is what he says. He celebrated suburbia as an expression of the natural anarchy of the human spirit. Believe it or not? Okay. This is him. It's the most practical solution for housing a family. It provides the home that most people want. It's not, after all, socially sterile. And its densities offer the best compromise between economy of land consumption, manageable walk to the shops, schools, etc., and sufficient space for children to play. And Frederick Olson from this country, the freedom of each architect, each householder, to express himself, that's what it is, as he saw fit, had moral and political as well as aesthetic significance. The facade was to express the special creative vision of the designer, just as the house represented the independence and identity of the family it contained. But if you go to the next slides, William Wimsatt in this country had the Bomb the Suburbs manifesto, regarding them as politically reactionary, economically unproductive, environmentally bad, socially atomized, and in terms of aesthetics, naff, dull, and tween. Okay. So let's go on to eco houses. Now, this is something that I'll be talking about more tomorrow, but I said yesterday, it seems to me that one of the key things for church, for the Kahal Yahwe, in thinking about what we ought to be doing in fashioning the built environment in our world today, we absolutely have to make environmental considerations a priority. This development here is Hockerton in the Midlands of England. There are three slides, I think, or four slides of it. No, three slides. Hockerton is a line of row houses which are completely self-sufficient. They reprocess all their own waste. They provide all their own energy. And there was a proposal. When I wrote my book, Newark Newark Town Council was going to try and use that design for council housing. I'm sorry to report that they've given up that plan. That's a quite celebrated development of eco-housing in Britain. If you go to the next slide, this is the eco-settlement where my daughter's been living. It's called Tinker's Bubble, and it's about 25 miles. Believe it or not, that's 1.5 hours drive from where I live. And that's the roundhouse, which is the heart of the community. The settlement uses no mainline energy whatsoever. It has a windmill to generate electricity when there's wind, and otherwise it uses wood for heating and cooking. And then if you go to the next slide, this is an eco house which is on the market today in Britain. It costs about $100,000, I suppose. It's about 70,000 quid. To put that in perspective, the earlier speculative houses which I showed you, which are the ones which are being built at breakneck speed all over Britain, cost 275,000. So these are 70,000. They're also autonomous houses. They provide all their own energy. They don't recycle. They don't reprocess their waste, but they have minimal energy impacts. They're built from a kit, and the question that I have is, you know, why on earth councils aren't building them? If you go to the next slide. That's the cover of Christopher Day's book. And he wants to think about houses and buildings as places of the soul. He has, for example, he says, in most houses, you go into hard plastered rooms. This is thistle plaster here. And he says, in most rooms, actually cry out for distraction. They demand a television or a stereo set or a radio. They want noise. And he tries to design rooms which, when you walk into them, ask you to be quiet and still, and where you don't want these kind of distractions. And that, he says, these are places for the soul. And he does that. For example, he only uses lime plaster. Lime plaster, unlike this stuff, is always rougher. It has a much softer finish. You have rounder, softer shapes to things. In his houses, he never puts in two windows of the same shape. So the windows are always different shapes around the houses. What's the other thing with them? I've lost my train of thought, don't worry. If we go on to the next slide. To try and think about the housing theme in terms of the Trinitarian scheme which I outlined yesterday. In virtue of the theology of creation, we're concerned for an ecologically sustainable form of building. The next slide. In virtue of the concern for justice, we're concerned for the right that everyone has for a decent house in a suitable environment. And the slide that I've given you there, I noticed that it's been copied back to front, is from Dundee. That housing is built by a social cooperative. It's municipally owned, so it's people rent it, but they pay a fair rent for it. To me, you can make your own comments, but to me that looks, quite an attractive housing development. And those houses have in fact proved tremendously popular with There's a long waiting list to get into them. And then, in virtue of our belief in the spirit, this is one of Christopher Day's houses there. In virtue of our belief in the spirit of work in all that makes for life, we're concerned with houses which speak to the human soul. So, if you go to the next slide. Again, taking up that question which we aired yesterday. I want to say aesthetics is not irrelevant to social justice. This was a theme of William Morris. He wanted to say rows of rectangular buildings oppress the freedom of the individual and depress the spirit. He went on, a house, a knife, a cup, anything that's made by man, forgive the gender, this is 1890, a house, a knife, a cup, anything that's made by human beings and has form must either be a work of art or destructive of art. That's Morris. The question is then, what we're going to do about our built environment. Build houses and dwell in them, says Jeremiah. Who is going to build them? Who is going to build them? That's the question. And if you go to the last slide, this is Numbers 11, which we were talking about yesterday. All the Lord's people are prophets. I would say, it's the thing that I try and advocate at home without much success, is that we need a new vernacular. We need to recover everyday possibility, the idea that people can create their own shelter, their own buildings. But to do that, what we need is education and spiritual discipline, because a profound vernacular, a vernacular which expresses, which builds places for the soul, which builds places which are beautiful, and give, enable fullness of life, those things don't come without education and spiritual discipline. Now, I understand church as a place for, if you like, the education of the soul. So the Kahal Yahweh for me is partly about being a place where the education of the spirit, the pedagogy of desire, takes place. The education of desire takes place. And what I want to say, and this is the last thing I'm going to say this morning, is that to be church is, amongst other things, to be a place where the education and the spiritual discipline which would enable a new kind of building which was empowering, which was beautiful, and which was ecologically sensitive could take place. Thank you for your attention.